skills can get a man killed, and quickly. I thank you, and my family will thank you also. Whatever you shall need, call upon us. I am obliged, but what I need I can find. Although I appreciate your consideration, and want only the respect and affection of your family. This is all very well, O'Crowley said, but to live a life well, discretion is needed as much as courage, and in this case, I would suggest that discretion would be a fast horse to Malaga, where a ship is being laden for the lowlands, and it is there that I myself am bound. There will be an inquiry, and it might well be that you would lie in prison until the problem is resolved. And that might be this year, or next, or the year after. I finished my chocolate. Vicente, my thanks for your hospitality. Take care to guard yourself. I am off. The most travelled road to Malaga was a busy one, so we took another to be out of sight. The death of one Maton in Madrid was not apt to attract notice, but that he'd been killed by a foreigner was. Those who hired Sarmiento could ask questions. Our mounts were good ones, for none are better than the Spanish horses. We rode swiftly, taking lonely trails through the mountains, places where a man must ever ride with a loose blade and a charged pistol. Yet we came at last to Malaga, and reported to our ship. Aboard, I saw at once what could be done, for I was just lately from doing the same on the ship I had sailed from England. Thus I went quietly about, making myself useful at familiar tasks. The following day, General Hugo O'Connor came aboard, and we put to sea. And it was well we were away, for the general told me that an order had been issued for my arrest. "Do not worry about it," he said. "I have spoken to the uncle of Vicente. Steps will be taken to clear your name. The charges against you will be dismissed within a fortnight. And should you ever return to Spain, all will be well." How can I relate the passage of years? Now that I look back, the memories are confused. The fierceness of one battle is lost in the glory of the next. The splendour of the days between, like a tapestry of joy, of sorrow. I remember with pain a fine horse shot from under me at Ivry. Such a splendid animal. I regret him still, for we had served much together. But strangely, he was wooed and won by battle. The sound of trumpets, of drums marching, the clash of arms. They were enough to fill him with excitement. He longed for the charge, the fray, the heat of battle. How many times he carried me where I might else not have gone. How many times was I called a hero because of that steed and the melees into which he took me. Truly, we were one. But often it was his decision that took me into the hottest part of the battle. Even a distant fight filled him with impatience. He would toss his noble head and tug at the bit, and his hooves would move restlessly, eager to be away. A history of my life during those years might be written in the history of the horses I rode. At Arc, I was wounded with a pike. At Ivry, I sustained minor cuts, bruises, and a small wound in the muscle of my thigh from a musket ball that all but missed. And was my side always the right side? I did not know, being but little versed in the politics of Europe. It was enough that it was the side I was on, the side that was paying me, for I had no country, no army, no government. Perhaps I was no better than Sarmiento, whom I had killed. I only know that war for many of us, who had no country, was a way of life. We were roundly defeated at Arc. Henry of France, who commanded against us, was a shrewd as well as a brave man, and he tricked us into a defile on the Béthune River. It is futile now to say I saw it coming, for during our long talks, Fergus MacCaskill taught me much of the tactics and science of war. That defile smelled of blood, and I shied from it. I spoke to O'Connor of it.
Aye,
he said grimly. But our orders take us there. More than 3,000 died there. That was September 89, and a bloody time it was. At Dreux, besieged by Henry, he lifted the siege and slipped away, because, as at Arc, his forces were less, and he chose to fight on ground of his own selection. That proved to be Ivry, and again Henry won. My horse killed, I joined the Swiss contingent. And when all others fled the field, the Swiss stood fast, and I with them. Obtaining honourable terms, the Swiss surrendered. Once again, I was a prisoner. It was to Henry IV himself that I was taken. Aside from the soldier who guarded me and two aides, we were alone. He looked up from the map he had been studying and eyed me coldly. You were with the Swiss, yet you are not Swiss. What are you, then? An Irishman, Your Majesty, taken at sea by the Spanish, yet fighting on the side of my enemies. My only means to escape was the army, sire. You were on an English ship? I was, sire. Yet you later fought valiantly against my men. I had no choice. It was fight or be killed. Besides, I admitted, once the battle is joined, I like to fight. He smiled ever so slightly. I know, he said dryly. I fight with some Irishmen, too. He sat back in his chair and studied me. There is an air about you, he said at last. That puzzles me. He looked down at the paper before him. Captain Chantry. I do not know the name. I shall make it known, sire. A name is only what one makes it. In the years to come, there will be other Henrys, as there have been in the past, but only one Henry of Navarre. Like all the Irish, he said, amused, you talk easily, and always with the right words. He scowled. Chantry, I know not the name. Should there not be a Mac or an O before it? I had another name once, I said, but put it aside long since. I discovered, I spoke wryly, that those of my name did not live long. When a land is taken and the people remain unconquered, it is considered wise to eliminate all those about whom an uprising might gather. Ah, and you are such a one? I am descended, I replied, from Nuada of the Silver Hand. Chieftain and king of the Tua de Danann, when first they migrated from the east into Ireland. A son of kings, then. We have no kings in Ireland, I said, and the hill of Tara is now grown over with grass. Where our halls and palaces once stood, the sheep now graze. The son of kings. Can I do less than treat you so? Yet how do I know this is not merely a clever story, concocted by your Irish wit? I have said so much, I replied, only because you are a king, and I am young enough still to believe in the honour of kings. There is no one to attest to what I am, and few who care. The English wish me dead, as I might in their place. You seem to hold little enmity toward them, he mused. I find this strange. Each of us does what he must do. I may kill the wolf who kills my sheep, but I understand him too. If the wolf must die that my sheep may live, so be it. But I need not hate the wolf for what it is his nature to be. Ah, you are a philosopher too. Well, what would you have me do? As your majesty wishes. Had I my choice, I'd be freed to return to England, to some day buy the land that was once my own. What was it like, your home? It is a green place, sire. Green among a chaos of granite. Bold hills and great boulders leaning. Moss growing at their feet. The forests that once covered Ireland are gone. But the land holds a memory of them. as all the rocks there have a memory of the sea that once washed upon them, and hollowed, and polished. The walls of my home were grey granite, and the beams and panels of oak. There was little furniture, but what there was also of oak. And at the door, a stream ran past. Swiftly it ran, hurrying down the steep rocks, to fall over a cliff and into the sea. There is a cove there, almost landlocked, where a man can have a boat, and there is the sea beyond, with fish awaiting, and the sound of the sea snarling and growling among the worn rocks. Sheep graze there, and there is a garden sometimes, and paths by which to walk the hills in the morning mist or evening shadow. There are far moors to gallop over on our fine Irish horses, or the wild ponies of the moors. It is a place to live and love in, sire, and I would go back there and abide, nor ever come away again. He shook his head. No man should be kept from such a dream. Does the house stand yet? It was burned, sire, but what men built, men can build again. I shall go back. Aye. Do you go then? He tossed a purse upon the table. Let a king share with a king. You have no sword? It was taken from me when I surrendered. So? He turned to an officer standing behind him. Gabriel, bring me the silver sword. The silver-handled one? But, sire, bring it. These are odd times. And this Irishman has brought me something of pleasure with his words and his ways. Perhaps he is a king, and certainly the sword should go to nothing less. The sword was a fine one, with a thin blade, at least 40 inches long, edged on both sides with razor sharpness. The hilt was of silver, beautifully turned, an emerald set in the top, and on either end of the guard. The scabbard, too, was finely wrought. Take it, and go your way. Gabriel, see he has a horse, a fine one, and this, too. Taking up a sheet of paper, he had written in a fine, flowing hand, Let this man, Datton Chantry, ride where he wills. And then he signed it, Henri. Go now, and may luck ride with you. Just before I vanished from earshot, I heard Gabriel say, Do you believe he is a son of kings? King Henry laughed. It does not matter. He carries himself like one, and has a certain style. He brightened my morning, and these days are dark, very dark. My horse was a dappled grey with a black mane and tail, a splendid horse. As I mounted, I remembered the words overheard. You too, Henry, I said aloud. You also carry yourself like a king, and you too have a style. Chapter 26 Alone I rode along the byways of France. Alone I dined at wayside taverns, or, pausing beside the road, ate of bread, cheese, and wine, while my good steed cropped the green grass of the roadside. Dark and thick was the cloak I wore, for strong blew the wind, and often cold the rain. Continual war had made the people sullen and remote, wanting no dealings with such as I, a wanderer returning from the wars. Although some looked long at my horse and my sword of the silver handle. Yet always I rode on, avoiding the main roads for fear of being stopped, and I was but once. An imperious officer, accompanied by 6 men, waved me down. Who are you, and from whence do you come? He demanded. I ride to Rouen, I said, and I come from Henry of Navarre. Some of his truculence vanished at that, but he did not truly believe until I rode close and showed him my letter. He stared at it, astonished, and then at me. I have never seen such a letter, he said. You must be a great man, indeed. I am a wayfarer, wishing to go on. Now, if you have done? The The sky was sullen, and a light rain was falling. Bundled in my cloak, I rode the dim sun down and into the clouded night, where the eyes gained only blackness, and the faint shine of rain pools in the muddy road. I drew my horse to a walk, for the footing was slippery. "Walk gently," I said to him, "for you carry an Irish lad on his way home." He twitched an ear at me. That I could see, but little else. What I dearly longed for was an inn, or any place at all, to shelter my head. Suddenly before me, the road took a branch off to the side, and I drew up, peering into the night. High above the road, I saw a dim reflection of light. The light tempted, but a faint smell of broiling meat scored victory, and for better or worse, I turned my horse into the side road and mounted steeply to what I soon saw was an ancient castle, long in ruins. A sensible man would have turned back, but I was Irish, and hungry to boot. Under a noble arch and into the courtyard I rode. At one side was an empty stable. I swung down and led my horse within. There was fresh hay there, and I tied him at a manger, bundled hay to him, and then loosened my sword in its sheath. I'd a brace of pistols with me, and I tucked them behind my belt and under the cloak. Then I mounted some ancient stairs, my nose following the aroma of the meat. I emerged in a room where there were five men and a girl, and the girl was bound. The surprise was complete, for myself as well as for them. The door I used was obviously not the one by which they had entered, for had I been a ghost, they could have been no more astonished. The men drew their weapons. "Hold," I said. The eyes of the girl lighted with hope when she saw me. Yet I knew not what happened here, or was likely to happen, except that five more miserable cutthroats I had never seen. "Attack," I said calmly, "and there will be bloodshed." Truer word was never spoke. The trouble was that the blood might well be mine, a chance I viewed with some discomfort. If I bleed, I bleed better in the sunlight, not upon a dark and stormy night in such a ruin. Yet it needed no seer to realize that I had stumbled upon some proper rogues, thieves, or worse. Spread before them and beside the fire was a nice collection of rings, candlesticks, and chains, most made of gold. "Who are you?" The speaker was a bold rascal, with somewhat protruding eyes and a greasy, unwashed look about him. A pity to thrust a clean blade into such a dirty ruffian. Who was I? A stupid question. For what did it matter? In a moment they would realize that I was one and they were five, and that I had come upon them at an inopportune time, from which I must not be allowed to escape. The girl they held bound was of quality, a lady by appearance and dress, though somewhat bedraggled at the moment. With all of that, a decidedly pretty girl. "I have come for her," I said, reaching with my left hand for the spit on which broiled the meat. I had not been a soldier these past many months for nothing. I took a generous bite of the meat, and, I continued, "if you be fleet of foot, you may make it to the river and so scape hanging." "Hanging?" One of them frowned sharply. "A cowardly rascal, if ever I saw one." "You I'll spit last," I told myself, "for you'll hang back and let the others risk."
"Who talks of hanging?"
The bold, dirty one said. "He must be first, clean blade or no.
Who in this forsaken land is there to hang anyone? And where do you come from? If you toss us your sword, we may let you go."
I smiled. Dirty though he was, I could almost like the man for his daring.
"A column of troops awaits me below," I said. "I came up looking for a bit of shelter."
Here I took another bite of the meat.
"And found you. There are the battlements here, and we have the ropes. Do you cut the lady free?"
I pointed the spit at the cowardly one.
"The rest of you have 1 minute to decide whether to run or hang." "He's lying."
"Do you want to risk it?" I said cheerfully. "If you have so many men,
Call them up, the bold one said. Ah, he was a worthy scoundrel. In due course, I said. He's lying, the bold one said. Take him. I had never thought to fool them. So when the nearest man raised suddenly up, coming off the ground, turning and drawing his blade, I thrust the end of the spit into his gaping mouth, taking a couple of his last remaining teeth with it. With my sword in my right hand, swiftly drawn, I plucked a pistol from my belt. It was point blank, scarce 10 feet, and I fired. The ball took a man in the chest, and he went down. Still clutching the now empty pistol, I crossed blades with a third man as the others closed in. Stepping quickly around, I was beside the girl with the fire between myself and the others. Two were down, and I was faced by three, one of them a hulking brute missing one thumb. See, he has no men outside. That shot would have brought them. Can't you hear their voices? I suggested. I lowered my blade and flicked that razor-like edge through one of the ropes that bound the lady's ankles. They began to circle the fire, coming from both sides. To face two, I must turn my side to another. I faced the two and went at them, moving swiftly toward them. The sudden attack made them back up. One lifted a heavy staff and struck down at my head. Avoiding it, I went in low, lifting the pistol in my left hand to ward off the blow. At the same time, I thrust. He had lunged when he swung his stick, and he spitted himself neatly on my sword. His mouth gaped at me, and his eyes, a milky blue, stared owlishly. I drew back sharply at a howl of agony from behind me, and glimpsed the third attacker scrambling from the flames. The girl, bless her heart, had somehow tripped him as he passed her, spilling him into the fire. He scrambled out, screaming and beating at his flaming clothes. Now it was just the bold one and myself. I looked across my blade at him and smiled. There was no coward in him, and he came at me. Suddenly and surprisingly, I knew this was no ordinary rogue. I faced a master. We fought desperately, silently, our blades like dancing light. Time and again I thought I had him, but each time he had a counter, a swift riposte, nor could he reach me. Suddenly he drew back and stopped. "Who are you?" he demanded. "From whence do you come?" Stepping back in my own time, I flipped my blade through those ropes that bound the girl's wrists. Quickly she freed herself. "Does it matter now?" I said carelessly. "You handle a blade exceeding well," he replied. "There are not 5 men in Europe who can stand against me." "I would think you could find a better trade," I commented, "and better company." He shrugged. "It is the fortunes of war. I was a gentleman once and knighted. My name is Tankerville. I held vast estates for my father and mother. There was much intrigue about court, and I supported the wrong side. We lost. Some of us were beheaded, some fled, some were imprisoned. My estates were taken by the crown, and I was lucky to escape with my head and a sword. That was 10 years, and now I am a brigand, living as best I can. And what of the lady here? Take care, and welcome. But guard yourself well, my friend, or she will have a knife in your ribs." I laughed. "You asked my name. It is Tatten Chantry, and I ride to Rouen. If you wish another bout with the blades, you have only to seek me out." "And I may," he said cheerfully. Tucking the empty pistol behind my belt, I touched the other to make sure it was still with me, and then, sword in hand, I backed from the room. The girl came with me. When I had recovered my horse, she said, "Their horses are down below, and mine also." "You were riding when they took you?" "Oh, no. They raided the chateau where I live. They came when they knew that all were away, and looted it, stealing all they could find. When I discovered them, they took me as well, exchanging their horses for our better ones.
Then let us get your horse.
Leading my own and walking beside her, we went down a steep path, and there in a clump of trees were the horses. She went straight to her horse. At the base of the tree to which he was tied, she picked up a small bundle. I helped her to the saddle, and together we rode down the slope and back to the high road which led toward Rouen. It led across a high, open plain with only rare clumps of trees. We rode briskly, and she seemed disinclined to talk. She was a comely lass, and I'd not have minded talking. But my few attempts to open a conversation came to nothing. "Where lies your home?" I asked finally.
"Yonder."
She pointed off to the south. "But I dare not go there now, for fear they might come back."
"Were there no servants?"
"They were away when the brigands came, and will not know what to make of my misfortune. I dare not go back. Take me with you to Rouen."
"Do you have friends there?"
"Of course. Although," she added, "it is a town to which I rarely go. Our market town was Dreux, although there were villages closer. My family is gone, and I am afraid to go back alone." It seemed a far way to take her from home. Yet she must know best, so I asked no further questions. The night was already well along, and I, for one, was weary. All day I had been riding, and my horse needed rest. The road was dark, and there were no stars. "Know you a place where we might take shelter?" I suggested. "The night has far to go, and my horse and I have been long upon the road."
"There is an abbey further along, and also an inn. The Great Stag, I believe, or something of the kind. I have not often come this way."
The village was small, and built along the banks of the Seine. But the hostelry itself was large for the time. Half-timbered in structure, it was a post-house. And I did recall some story that this was the place where the father of Henry of Navarre had died, after being wounded at the siege of Rouen. A single light showed from a lower window. The door opened readily enough at my knock, and a man in a leather jerkin held high a light.
"Two wayfarers," I said, "seeking food and shelter." "You be light, but come in nevertheless."
"We have horses," I suggested.
Aye, cannot I see? They will be taken care of."
He spoke in a mixture of French and English, and with a strong English accent. "You are an Englishman," I said.
"I am, although I married a French woman and have lived much of my life here."
He peered at me.
"You be English?"
"From the Hebrides, if you call that English." He showed us to a bench by the fire, and a fine fire it was, with a goodly blaze on the hearth. I extended my hands to it, and saw the man's eyes go to the maid with me. Her clothing was soiled from the rough treatment she'd received. Curiosity can be an ill thing, and can lead to all manner of speculation. So I thought to quiet his doubts at once.
"The lady and I have had a rough night of it. An encounter with brigands," I explained. "Well, well, 'tis not uncommon. They be fond of this country hereabouts, but not of this place. Here you may rest secure."
He gestured.
"All are asleep but me. Sit you, and when I have put up your horses, I shall find what food I can."
He disappeared, and after a few minutes returned and brought a loaf, some cold meat, and cheese to the table, and with it a bottle of cider. He looked again at me.
"The Dapple is your horse? I seem to know it."
"It was given me," I explained, "by the king."
"Aye." There was respect in his tone. "A fine animal. I knew I had seen it."
He glanced at my companion.
"And your horse also. I know it."
"We recovered it from the brigands," I said. He looked at my companion again, but offered no comment. Nor, to my surprise, did she. Although her home was some distance off,
Such a man as this would be likely to know any noble family thereabouts. Know of them, at least. When he was gone, I said, "You have not told me your name."
"Marie d'Harcourt,"
she replied. It was a familiar name. There were several d'Harcourt families, I believed, though I knew little of French names. Soon the man returned. When we had eaten, he showed us to our separate chambers. Marie clutched tight the strings of her bundle and refused help in carrying it. But once, when it bumped her leg, I heard a faint clank, a metallic sound. No sooner had my body touched the bed than I was off into a sound sleep and did not awaken until the sun was high. For a few minutes I lay still, then sat up, ordered some water brought, and bathed. The maid lingered at the door, glancing at me with large eyes and what seemed an inviting expression, although I was but a poor judge of such things. "Has the lady next door eaten?" I asked.
"She is gone."
"Gone?" She smiled openly at my astonishment.
"She left hours ago, before it was light."
I did not believe it, but a quick glance into her room proved the maid was right. Marie d'Harcourt was indeed gone. When I reached the common room of the inn, food was placed upon the table for me. He who served me was not the same who had served me the night before. He explained that the lady did not wish me disturbed. She had left at daylight on the road to Rouen. "It is not safe for her to be on the high road alone," I objected. "You should have awakened me."
"Do not worry," the innkeeper said dryly. "She will fare well. She has beauty, but she also has wit."
"You know her, then? You know Marie d'Harcourt?"
"I do not know her," he replied. "Nor is she a d'Harcourt, for of them I know much, and a fine family they are. What her name might be, I know not, but it is not d'Harcourt."
So, I had been fooled. But who was she, then? And who did the brigands believe she was?
"You had trouble along the road?"
I explained my adventures of the night before, and when I described my opponent, he shook his head.
"My friend, you are fortunate indeed, or one of the finest swordsmen in Europe. The man whom you met is André de Tancarville, and it is said no man has stood against him."
He related the story then. It followed the one Tancarville had told. The family had two branches, or so I have heard. The one intelligent, religious, devout. The other not religious, though nonetheless they were loyal to a fault, and of great courage also. My meal was complete. I paid what was required and stood up. Then the door opened and Tancarville stood there, his face flushed with hard riding in the wind, and with anger as well.
"Where is she?" he demanded.
"Gone," I said.
"She took it all, every last coin, every ring, every candlestick."
So that was what was in the bundle. How she had managed it, I did not know. And yet, when we were fighting, Tancarville and I, where was she then? Was she gathering up the more valuable jewels and hiding them on her person?
"We are fools, my friend, for she has duped us both and is away, gone 3 hours or more."
He slammed his fist upon the table, then dropped into a chair.
"Give him a mug of cider," I said, "and I shall have another. She's gone, my friend, so forget about it."
"Forget about it? There was a fortune there, a king's ransom, if you will. Not the gold so much as the gems, a full dozen of them." He gripped the handle of the mug and swore, then looked up at me and suddenly grinned.
"Ah, what a handy wench! She will fare well, that one."
"Where did you come upon her?"
"You may well ask. She is anything but a lady, though who she is, I do not know. I will not say how or where we came upon the treasure, but we came upon it.
She was also in the process of helping herself so we had no choice but to carry her off, at least far enough so she could not inform upon us. We talked no more, but finished our cider. I went to my horse, and Tankerville followed, muttering in his anger. When I swung to the saddle, I held down a hand to him. Enemies we had been, but he was a fine hand with a blade, and a daring rogue withal. "If you will," I said, "go to Henry of Navarre. He needs good fighting men, and I think he will be generous. Tell him Tatton Chantry sent you, though it may or may not help." With that, I was off to Rouen, with England just down the river and across the channel. It was in my thoughts that after nearly 4 years I would be close to my homeland again, home from captivity in Spain, from meeting with Henry, and all that had transpired between. And what of my ventures? What might have become of them after 4 years? And what of Ralph Leckenby? Chapter 27. The Rouen into which I rode, coming down a winding trail from the plateau above, was a bustling port, crowded with shipping from the sea and with boats and barges down the Seine from Paris. There were numerous inns and drinking places, and sailors everywhere, mingling with soldiers and civilians. I found an excellent hostelry close enough to the waterfront to observe the ships. There I stabled my horse and entered the inn. The room I had was small and neat and absolutely clean, which was a pleasure. Water was brought to me, and I bathed, taking my time about it, while considering my next move. To find a ship to England or Scotland, and one leaving at the earliest possible moment, was my most immediate goal. There were many here friendly to England, and once again, I must forget my Irish ancestry, and consider myself a native of the Hebrides. The keeper of the inn directed me to a nearby tailor, and I ordered 4 suits, head to heels, one of them for travel. While they were being made, I went to my horse. He was standing in a fine stall, munching very good hay, and seemed content to be there, but he took his nose from the manger and nudged me with it. I patted him on the shoulder, talked to him a bit, then walked out into the street, going first to the Quai du Havre, where I strolled along, examining the shipping. Several of the vessels were Flemish, and at least one was from the Mediterranean, a dark, low vessel that lay quietly alongside the quay, with no visible activity amid the bustle and confusion of the other ships. Some seamen loitered near a bollard, and I paused. "Here you ought to have a ship loading for England," I asked. They looked at me and made at first no reply. Then the smaller of the lot, a slim, wiry fellow, answered. "Little enough for there this fortnight," he said. "Mostly they are loading for the Baltic or the Mediterranean. Is it passage you seek?" "Aye. And if you hear of aught, I am Captain Chantry at the Hôtel des Bons Enfants, in the street of the same name. And there's a bit of silver for him who brings me a true word." "It will not be one of us who decides you may go," the man said. "Of course, just word of a ship. I shall do the rest if it can be done." My street was a bit of a walk from the quays, but the masts of the ships could be seen from my window, and it gave me a feeling of nearness, at least. Back at the inn, I seated myself in the common room, and ordered an omelette and a bottle of wine. It was the custom to eat but 2 meals, one at 10 and one at 4. But travellers such as I ate when hungry, and that I was. The omelette was excellent, and followed by a potpourri composed of veal, mutton, bacon, and vegetables. Suddenly, a man loomed over me. Glancing up, I saw a big, swarthy young man with rings in his ears. "You seek a ship for England?" "I do." "For yourself, alone?" "Myself and my horse, and the horse is a fine one. Do you know of such a ship?" "It may be. I shall speak to the master. It is to London we sail."
Bespeak a passage, then, for myself and a horse. The name is Chantry. He stared at me.
Be you Tatton Chantry?
The swordsman?
I am Tatton Chantry, and I have a sword.
Ah, the master will be pleased. The passage back was rough but short. When I led my horse down the gangplank to the London dock, he could have been no more pleased to reach land than I. Mounted, I rode at once to the house of Emma Delahaye. For a moment, I could only sit my horse and stare. The house was partly burned. The windows boarded over. Emma Delahaye was gone. I asked a passerby for news. He merely shrugged and walked on. I walked my horse up the street and stopped at a familiar sign. There a man named Holmes had a small shop where he sold clothes to sailors and the like.
Emma Delahaye, you say? Been gone for 4 years, Captain. Seen nothing of her all that time.
At my next question, he nodded.
The good Catherine? Aye, she came back, and many a time since. Good ship. Due in again soon.
My further inquiries concerning Emma Delahaye went for nothing. She had simply disappeared, vanished, and my money with her. At the old inn, Tom showed me to my old room.
I'll care for your horse, lad.
At my question, he shook his head.
Jacob? Been 3, almost 4 years. But he's a wandering man. No telling where he's come to by now. Sooner or later, he'll come back.
He brought me ale and sat down across from me.
Quiet it is, he said. All is quiet now.
He looked at me sharply.
You did him in, you know.
Who? Jacob?
Not Jacob. Oh, no, never him. I mean Leckinby. That last piece of yours, it destroyed him. It angered the Queen, and she had hard words for some of her people. They hanged a dozen of them at Tyburn, and put a few others behind bars. But not Leckinby. Oh, never him. He got off, skipped out, and is a wealthy man, they say.
And Tosti, I said, what of him?
I have not seen him. For a while, he was much about. A lonely man, I think. Yet all has changed here.
Robin Green is sunk far into drink, and all the talk now is of Kit Marlowe, Thomas Kidd, and Will Shakespeare. London had changed. Or perhaps it was I who had changed. For does a man ever remain the same? My voyage to sea, my captivity, mild though it had been, my experience of other lands and other peoples had had their effect upon me. When Tom had gone about his business, I sat long over my glass. I was older, 4 years older, and nigh on to 5. The months had passed quick in Spain, and in the wars as well. Now, looking back, they were a blur of confused images, with only a few moments standing out, stark and clear. Often they were the inconsequential moments, or what seemed so. In my pocket were a few gold coins from the purse given me by Henry. Beyond that, I had nothing. I was a man alone, without home, without estate, without family, and at this point, without friends. What was I to do? Find Emma Delahaye? Then how? She may have died, for the plague visited London often. My small fortune was gone, and my gold would not last long. Should I return to writing? But I was no writer, merely a man with some facility with words. Still, I had a story of the wars, perhaps several, and so, until fortune smiled again, perhaps... To sit idle was never my way. Somehow I must be doing. The England of Good Queen Bess was a country on the march. Merchants and tradesmen, once despised, now often held positions of honour. Some of them were acquiring coats of arms and being ushered into the gentry. Yeomen had become nobles,
and all was changing. Of the old families who had come with William from Normandy, few remained in any kind of power. A new order of men was rising, yet there was no lasting place for me in England. For sooner or later, questions would be asked, and my identity discovered. Richard Field. I would seek him out. With that in mind, I went to my room. At my small table, I began to compose a first-hand account of the Battle of Arques. To flesh it out, I included a brief account of Henry of Navarre. It was no obsequious, flattering picture, but a straightforward account of the man, his character, and his capabilities. Most of the night I worked, driving swiftly ahead, caught up by the excitement of my own narrative. It was not the picture from the long view, as so many were, but from the standpoint of the soldier in the field, of hand-to-hand combat, the clash of blades, the blood, the dying, the waiting, and the occasional flashes of humour. Next day, Richard Field greeted me as an old friend, for he at least had not changed, except that he was now risen in the world. His print shop was twice its former size, and he employed a dozen workmen and apprentices now, where there had been but two before. Alone in his private chamber where he conducted his business, he stood back and looked at me. "Ah, but you have changed. The boy has become the man. And that scar on your cheekbone?" "It was single combat at Ivry, between the armies, with a lieutenant of the Duke of Mayenne. I fought two such fights." "And what have you here? Another manuscript?" "A first-hand account of Arques." "Good. I think we can use it. Do another on Ivry." He glanced over the sheets of manuscript. "Ah, a picture of Henry of Navarre. That will hold much interest here." Seated over a glass of wine, I explained that I sought Emma Delahaye. Richard Field shrugged. "Who can say where she is? London is a vast place, and people come and go. She was a woman alone, and there are many murders, most of which go unpunished, and the murderers unfound. It might be that, or she might just have chosen to disappear. You spoke of the good Catherine. Her master may know something that would help you." For hours I wandered the streets of London, but saw no other familiar face. Tosti Paget, had he been here, would probably have known all, but he had disappeared. Then, at night in my chamber, I worked at telling the story of the Battle of Ivry, and noting down several others. One a tale of Spanish treasure I heard while there. When I saw him again, Field commented, "You, who are forever trying foreign ventures, should go to the Levant Company, lately chartered to carry on trade with Turkey, Venice, and all the eastern Mediterranean. It has the smell of a good thing, indeed. Besides," he added, "it were well to be free of London now, for the plague is such that soon all feasting must cease, and the theatres may soon be closed." We talked on various subjects, drinking our wine the while, and he told me much that had obtained whilst I was away to the wars. Despite what I had heard heretofore, he said he thought Robert Greene was dead, and that Edward Allen, the tragedian, had married Joan Woodward, stepdaughter to Philip Henslow, a theatre man himself. "There was great scandal, too, about the taking of the great Spanish ship," he continued. "A rich prize she was, and all who came aboard her made off with something, and none of them trifles. The Queen, they say, is furious. My Lord of Cumberland is he who finally laid her aboard and deserves the most, but some others, Raleigh among them, are much discontented." Late it was when at last we parted, and I started back through the streets alone. Yet I had two pistols, well charged, and my blade with the silver hilt. Emerging from the door, I saw a carriage drawn up down the street, all silent and standing, and I liked not the look of her, with two powerfully built men on her box. As I started past, the coach came forward, following me.
"You're daft, Chantry," I told myself. Yet it was coming up, moving more swiftly now, and I drew warily to one side and stepped into a doorway to have my back against something. The coach drew abreast and stopped, and a woman's gloved hand emerged from the curtained window. "Young man?" Holding myself ready, I replied, "Is there something you wish?" "Are you not the gallant Captain Chantry?"
"I am Captain Chantry."
I glanced to left and right.
"These are black streets, m'lady, and were I you, I should make the best of my way home. Thieves do haunt the streets about here, and no man is safe, let alone a woman. Will you not share my carriage? Come, do not be afraid. See?" She opened the door. "I am alone."
Curious and intrigued, I moved a step from the building. Indeed, she was alone, and as for the two men on the box, I counted myself quite their equal.
"What is it you wish?"
"Come, get in, and we will drive to your inn."
"Oh, yes, I know where it is. A strange place, too, by all accounts. One wonders if the handsome young captain is as guileless as he seems."
Curious indeed, I stepped into the carriage and seated myself opposite her. She laughed.
"What? Is the noble captain afraid, then? Will you not sit beside me, captain?"
"If I did so, I could not see your beauty half so well, m'lady." She laughed again and leaned toward me. She was masked. Her perfume was delicate and suited her. She was clad as for a ball, her white shoulders but barely covered, her hat riding upon a blonde coiffure.
"Come, captain. Do you so soon forget old friends?"
"I have cause to remember you, who were so gallant, and such a magnificent swordsman. My, I who have seen the best was amazed, and quick to act, too. Never a second's hesitation." She leaned back, so that her face was half in the shadow. Suddenly her bantering tone changed.
"Captain, I have long ears, for I have discovered that information is ever the price of victory, and I understand a venture upon which you depended much has failed you."
"It is the fortune of trade, m'lady."
"Indeed it is, and my informers tell me that while you ventured but little, your ventures were marked with success."
"Small success, and the woman I trusted disappeared, taking with her what little I had."
"But you trusted her?"
"Some men would think you a fool to trust any woman, particularly in a business way. Was she your mistress, too?"
"She was not," I replied stiffly. The coach had come to a halt. Looking out, I could see that she had indeed returned me to my inn. I moved as if to depart, but she put a hand on mine.
"Stay, I would talk a minute."
"Look you," she said, "who I am, or where I come from, does not at this time matter. You trusted a woman, and she failed you, or seems to have. I needs must trust a man, and I know no other who seems so likely a risk."
"I thank you. If there is anything..."
"There is, indeed." From a bag beside her on the seat, she took a smaller sack. "Take this. Count it well. And when you have done so, think how it might be invested. In the sack, you will also find a name and a place. You are not to try to discover who bears the name, nor go near the place until the venture is complete. Nor even then, unless in dire emergency. Do you, if you should leave England, return to this same inn? I shall find you. But, m'lady, I..." Her hand pressed mine.
"Take it.
I trust you. Indeed, there is no other I can trust. Even you may fail me. But as you are alone and without family, so am I. Do for me what you can. This that you hold may seem much, though it is not enough for what I need. Not enough for what you need either, although it is a step. Take this, and of the profits from the venture, you may keep half. That is all. Now go." Swinging down, I turned. I saw her face for a moment, but masked with a domino, such as women sometimes wore at masquerades, or when they wished not to be known. Her chin I saw, and her mouth. It was a firm little chin, and the lips were lovely. The eyes behind the mask seemed beautiful. She waved, and then the carriage began to roll. In a moment it had whipped around a corner and was gone. A moment I stared after it, then went into the inn and to my room. I put the sack upon the table, doffed my hat and coat, and bolted the door. Then I drew the string on the sack and dumped the contents upon the table. They fell in a dazzling heap, and one, rolling free of its companions, fell upon the floor. For a moment, I could only stare. Gems. Rare and beautiful gems. Not less than a dozen of them. Stooping, I recovered the one from the floor. It proved to be a ruby, and a fine one too. With one finger, I separated them. Three rubies, all of fair size, four diamonds, an emerald, three pink pearls, and a pendant of gold set with amber and onyx. I sat down on the bed. I was perspiring freely. For a few minutes I simply sat and stared, stunned by the enormity of it. Nor was I mistaken. My father had owned a few fine gems and had begun teaching me about them when I was very young. These were, as nearly as I could see in the light I had, excellent stones. Several had obviously been removed from their settings, losing a part of their value, no doubt. There were also three gold coins. They were all alike. Taking one, I examined it close to the light, but the inscription was in a language strange to me. Again I stirred the gems with my fingers, slowly pushing them together. 10,000 pounds? Closer to 50. And I was to have half of the profits.
Chapter 28. When I had completed my account of the Battle of Ivry and took it to Richard Field, he greeted me with the news that the good Catherine had come up the Thames only hours before, and was even now about to discharge her cargo. Taking my payment from him, I left at once. The good Catherine lay but a short distance away. The captain was a square, solid man, and he watched me board. I went to him on the quarter-deck. "I am Tatton Chantry," I explained. "I know you. You've become a famous man."
"It is not fame I seek, particularly that kind. Two things I need to know. The success of my venture, and the whereabouts of Emma Delahaye."
"Your ventures,"
he put emphasis on the plural,
"have been successful. I am a cautious man, Captain Chantry. Not a gambler, as many in the trade have become. I trade in staples, in established items. I do not look for gold or gems, just profitable trade. I was instructed to continue to reinvest what you ventured, and have done so. Come below to my cabin, and you shall see."
We went below, and he took from the grate a small pot.
"Hot chocolate," he said.
"It is something learned from Mexico."
"A habit I acquired in Spain," I said.
He glanced at me under his thick brows.
"Spain, Captain? I have been a prisoner there."
Briefly, I explained the circumstances of my capture.
"Good. You are a man after my own heart. There is a time to fight, and a time to talk. You saved your crew, and you saved yourself. The ship was already lost to you."
From a drawer he took a small book. On the cover was pasted a small square of paper. "Accounts of Captain Tatton Chantry." Opening it, he showed me in neat columns of figures the sum and total of my investments, and how each bit had been invested. I glanced at the total. Then I had to look again from surprise. He noticed it and smiled complacently.
"That is it, Captain. 9,462 pounds. I might add that having your money with which to work has made it easier for me.
There is no need to seek more adventurers to include their bits. I hope you will not see fit to withdraw all you have here.